Yes, Sue's boy.
Good.
The E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. And today we have, we're going to finish up on PS Minnesota's presentation. And then we are going to start in on the early childhood. Department will go through the early childhood initiatives. And next week on Tuesday and Wednesday, the governor's going to present his state of the state today at noon, and then I think next Monday he'll present his budget. And so we're going to leave it a little bit open in terms of what we'll do on Tuesday and Wednesday, hoping that we can probably get into some of the governor's educational initiatives that are in the budget, but that's what we'll start in on, we hope anyway, on Tuesday and Wednesday next week. So we will go back to Education Minnesota, and I think I see Superintendent Manel, you're going to have that highway worn out. We'll need that North Star rail line.
I'm really glad I drive a Prius. So would you like me to be joined at the table?
Yes, please.
Bodyguard 1 and Bodyguard 2. So.
And there's kind of pick up on your presentation yesterday, and then I think try to open it up for any questions that we'd have. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we get into questions?
Well, the Senator Scogin walked up to me and thanked me for not splashing the baptismal font his direction in my zeal, my evangelical zeal yesterday. I would suggest to you that in our public presentations, we've had several different responses to this. One is that we've had parents come to us after the fact and say, I understand this. I understand something that seems to be linked to the business that you're trying to perform, that while there are complexities within, there's certainly a rationality associated with the total PS Minnesota approach. I would suggest as we would move forward with the conversation that we talk about doing this as a total reform initiative as opposed to suggesting this idea sounds good and this idea in isolation might fix one element of the challenge we see, but will not reconcile an entire problem. The other response that we've gotten from folks as we've talked about this, and as a matter of fact, something that we say pretty plainly, is that we really believe that the system that we have designed is predicated on a greater good principle. When we have three divergent organizations sitting side by side working out a very complex set of circumstances and coming to some conclusions about how things should be done, one could argue that if any compromise has been made, the compromise has been made around what we believe is for the greater good of all of the children of Minnesota, as opposed to what is simply best for the organization that I serve. I would ask that as we move forward, we continue with that spirit in mind as well. Beyond that, we really did have an opportunity yesterday to present most of our proposal, Mr. Chair and committee, and we'd be happy to be responsive to any questions that you might have.
Okay. I guess one of the thoughts that I had was given that it's like a package and it's a relatively, you know, complete package, if we move forward and cannot, you know, adopt the whole package, what are the key elements that it's kind of asking you to kind of unassemble some of it, but it seems like the hard information that you have in here, obviously one is you've kind of settled on a number, And, well, maybe just jump back a little bit. There's an element of adequacy in terms of the overall number, adequacy in terms of finance resources. And then there's, I think, how do we get to that number? The number that you didn't really refer to yesterday, I don't think, but it's assumed that it's around $1 billion. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, the billion-dollar number was referenced by one of the other presenters. In fact, that billion-dollar number came out of initial APA research. John Myers and his firm did that work. And while there is no question that there's a part of our advocacy that's targeted toward a sum of money, we really have been more intent on a system of money. I really believe that if you create a structure that has a rational link to what it is we're supposed to accomplish, that the resource will follow. So while we could debate the merits of the APA study and talk about whether it was predicated on sound research, that really was not our intent. Our intent was to talk more about the framework for funding rather than about what the product of all that funding formula might be.
To follow up just a little bit on that, that number then translated into your framework of funding. Was there much discussion about what part of that should be state resources, what part of it should be local in terms of the breakdown of right now we're assuming that at least in the 2001 overhaul it would have been, you know, the general education formula would have been all state. And of course, you know, you've seen these charts where it started out close to it, but then now we've slid away from it. Was there any discussion in your group about, and I personally don't think the state's commitment to 100% is real. I mean, it hasn't borne out that way, and I don't think that it's sustainable. Was there much interaction about, you know, what should the state put in and what should the local communities put in?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had considerable discussion in the background. And perhaps it would be interesting, maybe not interesting for you, but illuminating for me to talk a little bit about my role. I serve as a facilitator for this group and as a spokesperson, and I quip this maybe because I have the biggest mouth, and it probably is true. In fact, what I've done is I've tried to bring different individuals to the table and keep them at the table and engage in conversations. And we heard many, many conversations about what the right mix might be. Ultimately, our determination was that's a policy decision that is best left to state policymakers. And what we simply believe is the principle of sound finance, if you talk about sustainability, talk about dependability, stability, would be the blend between the local property base and the state base. Personally, I could advocate for a system as a foundation not too dissimilar from what used to be in place, the blend that was predicated on property wealth. Now, if you were to put that back into place this instant, that would be a challenge for my school district. So, done in isolation, it would be a problem. But as a long-term target, I think it would be appropriate. In point of fact, schools in Minnesota are funded today on a blend of state resource and local property wealth. But the local property wealth portion of it comes into play at the operating referendum. And the districts that have the capacity to put a referendum in place are, in fact, supporting their basic education program out of their local property taxpayer. I would argue that that's not an equal system. It's not a fair system. And so a return to a system that blends in an equalized fashion property wealth and state resource would be the best system.
Senator Hand, is that a question? Okay.
Senator Hand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate your coming back again today and willing to talk some more. One of the questions that I had in the course of the presentation and reading the material, you've talked about that a good formula, a good funding structure has to be targeted toward achievement. And I think a lot of us have concern about how we can get better at achieving results on a more dependable basis. But it's unclear to me how the proposal that you've put on the table, it's a formula. It's a different formula, slightly. As you said, some things are similar to what we have today, and other things are a little different. But what is unique about it that targets this formula to achievement that the current formula doesn't do? I think a lot of us, in the course of the years, when we put things on the current formula, there was the belief that we were going to get student achievement by putting money into that formula. Now we're proposing a different structure, but I'm not clear yet what are the unique characteristics of that formula that do target it to achievement, whereas the current formula does not. Is it something you can talk about a little bit and explain?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I would suggest that I could pose a rhetorical. Why is the foundation formula set where it's at today? And I think the response would be it's a function of what the available resource has been, what the political will has been. And in some fashion, structures have been created in some fashion to connect, to link to that available resource. What we're suggesting is, and what is happening nationwide, this isn't just happening in Minnesota, is an examination should be made of the standards that are expected of schools. And we have standards currently in statute that have not been in statute in the past. We've got federal statute in No Child Left Behind. Instead of saying what is available resource and simply design programs around that, what's different is this is looking at what is the standard that we're expected to deliver, and then doing the cost analysis associated with the delivery of those standards. That's a fundamental shift in the mindset. While the formula itself might look similar when it's done, it's constructed in a different fashion. Instead of looking at resource, it's looking at outcome, expectation. That's how it might be better linked to achievement.
Senator Hannah.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. So the assumption is that if we have a better funding mechanism or more money, presumably, then the achievement of the standards is possible, whereas under the current level of funding, the achievement of the standards is not possible. Is that the logic here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I would suggest to you that this is not, again, an either-or proposition. It's a continuum. And I would suggest to you that along that continuum, I have a greater likelihood of achieving the required standards, and, in fact, delivering more than required standards if I have a sufficiency of resource, as opposed to if I have an insufficiency of resource. Will I still be able to accomplish, make progress? Certainly. How much is related to how much resource is available to me?
Senator Salzberg.
I guess, Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a question, that there are two things here. There's a new funding formula, and then there's one slide that has a dollar amount on it. And I think there's some confusion at times that we're talking about a funding formula versus how much goes into that funding formula. Do you have a sense of to do some of the reforms that are going to create greater efficiency? Because I think that's very important that we use our dollars wisely. Is there a cost to creating reform? Because I know that the superintendent's report, which is a world-class school, I believe, talks about some of the reforms, which is a third piece of this. Is there a sense that when you perhaps create reform that there's a cost to that? And have you considered that at all in these dollar amounts?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, I have attempted to link our work, in fact, to some of the work done by MASA in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. I see Executive Director of MASA, Charlie Kite, here. We were just talking about a presentation he's going to be making. I don't know if it's to this committee or to another on the world-class schools proposition. One of the tenets in the world-class schools study was that a world-class school system needs to be supported by sustainable, sufficient resources. So in that fashion, we are linked. In another fashion, we're linked because we recognize that if we're going to step up onto this world stage, if we're going to compete in a global economy, it isn't enough to be merely adequate. And in some fashion, it's difficult for me to even be referencing adequacy studies. I don't go to, I think, a merely adequate doctor. I don't look for a merely adequate car mechanic. We look for excellence. Excellence comes at cost. Have we costed excellence? No. Frankly, if we were to put numbers in front of you this morning and we were to say that we want to have higher sets of standards still than are in statute, one would argue that a greater investment would need to be made. We're here again to talk about a structure that looks at what the state expects of its schools, what the nation expects of its schools, and we're trying to cost in accordance with that. Frankly, if this governing body would choose to ramp up the standards, I think we'd all embrace that kind of a conversation, then we would argue that a ramp-up of investment would also be required, just in most any industry.
If I could add. Mr. Chair, if I could add.
Mr. Lindell.
I was the chair of the solutions portion of the effort, and I think that the we talked about one of the things we were talking about doing, and that was is white papers that that were never written. But we did talk about that at one juncture to have kind of a list or a of some of the things that are being talked about both in this state and nationally: high school restructuring, response to intervention, and all-day kindergarten. What are some of the investments that we can make to close the achievement gap and raise the, and also raise the achievement of all students? Like I say, we didn't get, we were both strapped for time and manpower, so we didn't finish that effort. But I think that there are costs, there are things that are happening, and things that do need to happen. I think the one issue that I've had with a lot of things over the years is reform does cost money. At least initially, it's going to cost money because you're going to be changing the system. And given the system that we have, we just can't all of a sudden wipe out all rules and say, it's going to cost less. You're going to have some transition time, and you're going to have, there's probably going to be some initial investments that are going to, fuel that transition. I don't think that there's any question about that. And I also think that we just have to be realistic, as Dr. Vondel said. The Chinese aren't going to be sending over the junior varsity. They're competing with us. We read Friedman's "The World Is Flat." It's very, very important that we're in a position to, raise our levels and expectations. And again, that takes investment. I guess I depart a little bit from the distinguished Dr. Vondel on the money question. I think that we clearly have shown in this study to deliver the standards and deliver the standards to all students. I think we have to, step back 10 years. Once upon a time, there were no state standards. Once upon a time, there were no national standards. Once upon a time, there was no Child Left Behind. These things are all the realities that schools deal with now, and that costs money. To deliver to all students, to get 100% proficiency, that costs money.
Senator Salzman.
Mr. Chair, I just want to share that in my community, which is the East Metro area, we have a number of people who own businesses, who travel to Asia, who travel around the world. And they come back and they share with us what they're seeing in these other countries. And they're having discussions about raising standards, and they're fueling their economy by investing in education. And my concern is that as we sit here, we talk about greater efficiency. We need to start talking about those programs that truly work, that we see are working with our students. We're seeing prevention programs that work. We're seeing lots of things. And yet sometimes I think we get tied into the minutia. Now, we need to be accountable to our public, but at some point I think we need to have a serious discussion of what we need to do to stay competitive in this state. This is a model, I think, that instead of pouring more money into a system that has been here since the early 70s, we've put Band-Aids on it. I've advocated for some of those Band-Aids in the past, that we need to have a serious discussion of what might we do this year, whether or not we can do all of this, but what in this proposal might be a starting point. If we do put investments into education, how can we use this system as a way to start changing the way we fund our schools in Minnesota and to have greater accountability? And I think it's a starting point. I just think this is a good place for discussion. It's early in the session. I think we should be asking the tough questions, and I certainly support Senator Hannan in talking about efficiency, is that we've got to make sure that every dollar we spend is truly going to go to greater student achievement. And that's going to take some hard questions with groups that we're going to have to ask some hard questions of. So thank you.
I'm got a list I'm working on here. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Salzman and gentlemen, one of my problems is that what I see as you presented yesterday, yes, there were some changes, but we basically took the same box and rearranged the contents and put a little different label on it and a nicer bow, but we still have a real piecemeal funding system out of what you presented. I'll admit that I do like parts of it, but we're still into, I would say in some ways, minutia from district to district, where we still have, I would say that every district in Minnesota has some unique characteristics that take funding to take care of. And this piecemeal approach still creates winners and losers within the educational system. It still doesn't fairly fund every school within the state of Minnesota. And I didn't see that component in it at all. For instance, we have districts within my Senate district that spend $1,253 less than the state average, because that's all the state average, not the state maximum, the state average, because that's the way we fund our system so piecemeal. So even though I appreciate the work you did, I still think we ended up with the same box of all kinds of little categoricals to create winners and losers within our school system, and I've never liked that very well at all, because I think every school has unique characteristics to deal with, whether it's logistics or student problems or things like that.
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, it's a fundamental question, and it is one that goes to a kind of a personal philosophy. And I would suggest to you that fair and equal are not necessarily the same, and I know you understand that. I would suggest no one is in quest for a system that is purely equal. That would be, we would need to be representing anybody if we simply said, here's how much money divided equally by the number of kids in the state, and we're done. We understand that students have individual characteristics, and it's important, it's fair, it's right that we address those. And we understand that districts have individual characteristics, and we're making the same argument. We're not arguing to move to the level of minutia that a formula requires a supercomputer in order to manage. What we're advocating, however, is a system that acknowledges the more generally accepted differences that are rationally linked to student achievement and fund those in accordance with the resource that's available. So we really genuinely are advocating a system that might create differences. I would not argue winners and losers. I'll suggest that I sit side by side with a Sartell School District, and we look similar in some cases. But if we were to do pupil counts, and we both serve 4,000 kids, if we do pupil counts under this analysis, we may find that Sartell should be funded based on their ELL population for 4,800 pupil units, where Sauk Rapids Rice should be only funded for 42. Why? Because maybe Sartell has a higher ELL population or higher at-risk population or whatever. That really is something we are suggesting is fair and right. Some view that to be winners and losers. Others would view that to be meeting the needs of children in accordance with their standard. That's really what we're about. And I know Mr. Lundell would also wish to add to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, just, you know, I represent many of the districts in your Senate district, and I think what and we've talked about this a lot in the Solutions Committee, and I think what Dr. Vondell has said is, you know, is very, very true. What we're trying to do is, there are going to be differences, but we have to make sure the districts that aren't really qualifying for any differences still have adequate funding for education for what the program that they have without having to, pass referenda to do the base program. We talked prior to the meeting about the varying ability within your Senate district to pass referenda, and you look at Princeton, where it was pulling teeth to pass a referendum that is $450 less than the state average. And to get that passed was, I mean, they were like doing cartwheels because they finally passed a referendum. $200 a kid. You look at other districts in the state where $200 a kid, they don't even bother going out for a referendum. I mean, I think so that's one of the things that we've talked about here is that the random nature, and we need to get that basic formula up to a sufficient level so that the Big Lakes and the Princetons aren't compromised when dollars are put into those places that have unique needs or unique needs beyond the base. I think that's the point we're getting at when I talk about we're needing more money. As you all here have to make decisions based on a limited amount of resource or a resource that may not be sufficient to meet the needs statewide, any dollar that goes out of Big Lake already hurts a situation that isn't very good. I mean, they do a good job in Big Lake, but they have to make tough decisions too because they don't get any categorical. So any dollar going into a categorical is coming out of a district like Big Lake, which gets next to no categoricals. What we're saying is get the base amount high enough so that distribution of categoricals is not adversely affecting those districts that aren't qualifying for categoricals. And I think that's what we're trying to do in costing this out, is to say in order to do that, in order to not compromise those districts that either have low referenda, and this happens, I think, in the western suburbs as well, with districts like Wayzata and Minnetonka who get no categoricals, but do have a little bit more property wealth, a little bit more willingness to pass referenda. I would argue, is the system fair for them? Should they have to go pass referenda to do what is a state obligation? Probably not. And I mean, and they have property wealth and probably more willingness to do that, I think, but that's kind of evaporating as well. So what we're trying to say is what that base amount should be, and Senator Stumpf is probably going to need to be some property wealth and some both property and state resources. But I think that's what we were trying to accomplish here, is to get to a base level that's going to address those issues without having the categoricals, start this kind of redistribution to say, I always use the dozen eggs. Well, Scott did a better job this year than Brad, so he gets more eggs than I do. Minneapolis and St. Paul does a good, 1 year, and they get, but we're always talking about a dozen eggs. We need to be talking about two dozen eggs. And then say we get what we need in terms of adequacy, and then we can zero in on those districts with categoricals that have very unique and very recognizable learning challenges. I think that's what our effort was here, and I think hopefully that clarifies it a little bit.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you. Just to follow up, Superintendent Vendel, I've never advocated for every student being at exactly the same level of funding. I think that's a pretty utopian thought because there are distinct differences. But I do, as you said, Mr. Lindell, advocate for very good funding for base student count. But beyond that, I think the categoricals have to be extremely limited, and I'll put it that way, extremely limited in the categoricals, incredibly well thought out, and based on sound principles of what it actually takes to educate the child that fits within that categorical. And I don't think that what you presented went far enough in that way. If I will fully admit that I think at the end of it, I still saw all the categoricals popping up. And I think we're still just trying to please everybody instead of doing what's a really good, sound policy for school funding.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, what I would say to that is that that's why we're here today and what we're asking for. And I think that there's some questions of what was the initial, why did we do this? We brought this to the point where we can probably bring it, and we need to hand it over to the people that, have the checkbook and have the election certificates, I guess, because we need to now hand this over to people with that have greater capabilities than we do to really deal with the political question that is at the heart of a lot of this. There's a point at which the think tanks don't make the laws, and I think the legislatures make the laws. That's the way it needs to be, and that's why we're coming to here, like in Maryland, where this probably worked the best, this process worked the best, they had legislative investment from the get-go. We've kind of taken this where we can go with it. The legislature has to pick it up from here.
Okay. Senator Hand isn't here. Okay. Senator Roebling, and then Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I think a lot of us were probably just hoping to see something that was a lot simpler if we were to reorganize the formula. But I'm looking at what you're saying are the nine characteristics of a good funding formula, and I can't say that I really disagree with any of them. And so, in a way, there you have set up for nine categoricals almost. And And we will debate these, whether these should be different categories or not, and how much they're worth. And that brings me to one of the questions that kind of goes back to yesterday, because this is a big one, and that is the free and reduced lunch figure that you came up at 0.75 and the English learners at 0.90. And I am trying to figure out how you reach those numbers, because they're significant. A 0.90 is almost double what a standard student would be getting. And so I'm just trying to figure out how you came to that.
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, we, in fact, commissioned that work. We commissioned it through Augenblick, Palash & Associates and John Myers, who has done work in actually all 50 states. He used methodologies that are respected in the scientific, in the research community. It's wrong to call this pure science. It's not pure science. Using statistical devices and using costing out studies from other states and looking at Minnesota's data is where he came to the conclusion of 0.75 and 0.90. Could I cast my lot in life on 0.75 and 0.90? I don't know that I have that level of confidence, but I have confidence that it's close, and I have confidence that research study would produce acceptable numbers that are rational and that are linked to the learning that our children might have. So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that if conceptually we buy into the need to do the analysis and then we do the appropriate study and set the weighting factor, the costs associated with this business in accordance with that sound research, we've taken a huge step ahead from the current system.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelman is not here. I was just going to ask what the current additional funding for those students was. What do we add on?
I think could you just restate your question? We were visiting here about some other numbers.
I'm not sure what the current additional funding for students on free and reduced lunch and English learners is now in the compensatory formulas.
I think it varies. It varies according to, well, there's a number of different programs, but in the compensatory, it varies due to the density of those concentration factor. So you'd have to almost, I think there actually maybe is a chart to show how that goes, but the line kind of goes up like that, because as the concentration of those students is more dense, the dollars that they receive goes up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I was I can speak to LEP because I was just looking at that, and I think the others are similar. But LEP is calculated on a per pupil, and then it's also calculated on a concentration. So there's a calculation for LEP, a total revenue for LEP that's $700 per LEP pupil unit. And then there's also LEP included in a basic skills revenue that is $250 per pupil unit based on the concentration of the LEP pupils in that district. Special ed is a reimbursement, and free and reduced lunch is more similar to an LEP.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I can't tell you how appreciative I am that you posed that question to the chair rather than to the superintendent.
Okay, we have Senator Hand is back, and then Senator Bonhoff and Senator Olson. Senator Hand. Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, are you calling on me next?
Yes,
year? Thank
Senator
you.
Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Bondell, I want to get back and try to get clearer on the linkage of the formula that you're proposing to achievement. And I guess the premise of my question is if you look back over the past 20 years or so, and if you look at all the funding streams, not just the general formula, but all the funding, local categoricals, And the Department of Education website, it says that it's increased over inflation, at least measured by CPI, by some 25%. So there's been an increase in total education funding over the past 20 years. Whether it's adequate or not is debatable, but it clearly hasn't been extremely effective at producing better results. I think we can agree on that, that even though whatever money's been out there, you look back and say, well, has there been the steady progress and achievement? And I think we can say that probably hasn't happened. And so I'm intrigued by your idea that it's not maybe it's the structure of the formula that has to be changed to link the funding to stronger achievement results. And so I guess one question I have is, if we took the current dollars that we're spending and put them into the new formula, what would that look like? And maybe we could get Mr. Nauman or somebody to do a run to say, if we had the same dollars but spread it according to the new formula, what would that look like district by district, and what would the result of that be? Or maybe it's not, I'm not clear on this, maybe it's not possible to do that. There may be things in the formula that would require more dollars than are currently available. And can you respond to that, or is that something we could take a look at to see whether that, what kind of difference that would make district by district in terms of what gets funded and where the money goes?
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I'm going to suggest, I'm going to provide a response to the question, though. You laid out a couple of premises that I'm not sure that I would accept in terms of increased investment in schools, and we're not making progress in terms of performance. But I'm going to take the next step into this in any event. What you are suggesting is some of what we would hope could be accomplished. We recognize, I said yesterday about intellectual horsepower and analytical horsepower, and I saw the two staffers smile a little bit down at that end. I wasn't just schmoozing. They're very powerful individuals. I have a lot of good information. We would love to be able to begin to tap into that resource. That's some of our purpose sitting with you today, is to see if there is a way that we can begin to do that kind of modeling, that kind of an examination. Because Brad and I don't disagree that this is about money. It certainly is about money. And we also don't disagree that it's about frameworks. But I'm here advocating framework perhaps more than I've ever advocated in the past, because I really do believe if we put a rational construct in place, we're going to be able to get to the answers to some of the questions that you posed, that were posed yesterday about achievement, that are posed today. But the system that we currently have in place doesn't have a rational foundation. It's a system designed in an old world where there were no requirements per se set in statute or wherever. That was left to the discretion of individual school boards. We're in an environment today where we have standards clearly outlined in the law. And actually, frankly, we know there are penalties for not meeting those. We're arguing that if we're required to meet a set of standards, then we need a system of funding that's linked to those standards. That really leads us to the additional study, and we'd love that engagement. I know this is a gentleman who's trying to jump in a couple of things as well.
Mr. Kronquist.
Mr. Chairman, Scott Kronquist, Association of Metro School Districts. I think part of the confusion here is we're really talking about two different things. The John Myers work was an adequacy study. All right, so that really, John Myers wasn't coming up to it with a new formula, or you know, he offered suggestions, certainly, but his we commissioned him to perform an adequacy study based on, as my two colleagues here have pointed out, the requirements under state and federal law. And the primary one, and the one that really drives that number that takes our breath away a little bit, is the federal requirement that 100% of all students are proficient. That, let's face it, that's what drives the cost up of this. Because that has never been an expectation of public schools in this country. It is not a standard that any country in the world is meeting currently. And so I think it's very important you keep that in the back of your mind. Now, we actually have not brought you a new formula. We've brought you a set of recommendations, a framework that a new formula would fit into, that we would suggest that any new formula should be measured against. Does it meet these certain criteria? So I would just suggest that it's important to kind of keep those different distinctions in mind as you're considering moving forward.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On to your questions, because I've got a few more people here.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Bonhoff. Chair. Members, I want to speak to actually what Senator Hahn said and then what Mr. Kronquist just said, because I think that is the disconnect, is that we're having this conversation about a formula that's linked to achievement, and yet in the same conversation we're saying that we're not using the premise of the adequacy study as the basis for the formula. So to me, those two things are disconnected. If we say that that we're not going to fully discuss the adequacy study, which said in order to get to 100%, it will cost this, then how can we even begin to have a discussion around a formula that we're not even adding up the numbers to see does it equal that? Because there are people here are saying you're not willing to put your hat on, here's where we need to get to. So I'm having some trouble really supporting the premises when nobody is even saying we're trying to get. I just think that we're talking about two different things here, and so without really saying what does it cost, and then what does it cost has so many different variables that need to be discussed and looked at and vetted, and you know, how do we measure achievement, what is success? That's one whole set of questions. And then with regard to this formula, I'm curious what the numbers add up to. It's hard for me to really evaluate whether your formula works without seeing what it adds up to and comparing that to adequacy and comparing it to what we're currently doing.
Senator Stubb, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, the numbers in the Myers report actually are a range of between $1 billion and $1.7 billion. And I'll suggest to you that that is only looking really at the learner component and then that second component, the district instructional services component. It doesn't take into account the district support services component. It doesn't take into account the cost of capital infrastructure or transportation or things like that. We commissioned the Myers report, and we're not running away from it. But we recognize that when we start talking about those kinds of numbers, people either become horrified or their eyes glaze over as this is totally not feasible. And would the education establishment benefit from that kind of an increased investment? Without a doubt. Would I advocate that this body should consider a significant increase in investment? Yes. But frankly, it would not be enough simply to say whatever money you've got available, we'll divide it across the state on a per pupil basis, we'll add it to the existing formula and move forward. That would be easy, but that would be a poor compromise. The better approach would be to suggest we are informed by a body of research that suggests here's what the cost of adequacy is, and we also are informed by a think tank approach to the creation of a formula that is rationally linked to what it is we wish to accomplish. So we would ask that they move side by side. And frankly, if you as a group are suggesting, well, that APA report was commissioned by a bunch of education groups, what did you expect the result to be? Then we would simply suggest that another agency, a body like this, could commission an adequacy study of its own and come up with an independent conclusion, a more independent conclusion, though there's certainly politics associated with a House or a Senate doing this as well. But no, Senator Hansen, no, that's impossible. But one way or the other, you would be informed in your decisions by research as opposed to simply suggesting this is a decision vested purely in politics and purely in available resource.
Senator Baugh?
Mr. Chair, and then in completion, though, what is your numbers? What do they add up to? If you use your base formula and the variables, have you added up the numbers, and do we have a total?
Mr. Vandell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, have we added up the total? We've done some individual runs on school districts, and we recognize that this is a work in progress. I sit here as a district that doesn't do very well under this particular construct. Why? Because I'm a district that doesn't have sparsity, and it doesn't have a high ELL, and it's not really big or really small. And so I'd say to you that there would be distinct winners and losers because we haven't taken this far enough. We didn't do the capital analysis or the transportation analysis. However, in concept, the framework taken to the next level and informed by appropriate research would work for Sauk Rapids Rise as it would work for districts all across the state of Minnesota. What does it cost as it stands? I'd have to say the billion to 1.7 billion is the best number we have currently because it's the only research that has been done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to add to that, I think that, again, we're just, we lack election certificates here on this side of the table. So it's hard for us, again, to go further with this. But it's just, it is a work in progress. And I think that we just have to, you know, we're coming forward, you know, with that in mind. And I think it's just, it's, again, we just have to, you know, turn it over to people who are going to be in the position to, you know, fiddle with the dials. And that is political. I mean, I say that with a small p. Political is my education funding has always been and always will be political. It's where people are coming to you make the very important decisions, and there's a political element to that. I don't think we should shy away from that. But it also needs to be more policy-driven and research-driven than it has been in the past.
Mr. Chair, can I return to an observation made by Senator Bonhoff before you move to the next question? You made an excellent observation a little bit earlier. Whether you buy these nine characteristics as being the gospel or not, to return a little bit to my evangelical roots, they are a good place to start. Whatever you choose to do, if you begin to measure that action in accordance with some set of principles of school funding, you're going to have a better system. And I would challenge that is not necessarily the way decisions have been made here. They've been more vested in politics than in the policy of the greater good. And I think these characteristics are vested more in the policy of the greater good.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Superintendent Vandella or others, we started out, and my thoughts here were triggered by Senator Roebling's questions related to the at-risk, the free and reduced price lunch, and the English as a second language. You've proposed a pupil waiting related to those. We've also discussed as a follow-up to that, what about concentration? I don't see concentration recognized in your construct. Does that mean that you would recommend that we put the weighting on each of the pupils and not, as a policy matter, not have a concentration factor? And do you have a research base for that decision or that recommendation?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, in fact, there is a research base on that, and we've had considerable discussion about that. As a matter of fact, the keeper of concentration just snuck in on my left side here, because Jim has spent a lot of time, Jim Grathwell from Minneapolis Schools, spent a lot of time advocating on behalf of concentrations. He has even, at some point in time, conceded that as we've looked at the Myers research, the APA work, that appropriately weighted factors for ELL and for at-risk preclude the need for concentration. As a matter of fact, if you get deep inside some of that APA work, they would argue that the economies of scale begin to come into play, and you might actually have a greater level of resource than you might need if that concentration, or if the weightings are appropriate. So we really moved away from concentrations and focused our attention on appropriately weighting instead. And I'm just going to turn to Mr. Grathwell and have him contradict what I said or whatever he'd like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm the designated hitter on this issue. So Mr. Greenquist needed to step away. And thank you, Superintendent Vandell. And he said conceded, not conceited. I just want to clear that for the record. Your question as to whether or not there's a research basis for concentration, the APA work looked at a national across all states. And if you look across all states, what you'll find is some states give short shrift to places where there are concentrations of poverty. Some states level fund equally. And we are among the very few states where we put additional resources through a concentration formula where there's what I think there's consensus that we agree that where there are concentrations of poverty, you're going to see concentrations of need or a greater achievement gap, and that's what shows up when, if you look at AYP or any of our testing results. And so Minnesota has been a policy leader in that respect. But if APA's work is based on a national basis, that's why you wind up with a result in their report where it's a rather than a slope, now drawing where the concentration generates revenue like that, more revenue at the highest concentration of poverty. The APA report has a level 0.75 per pupil. We haven't modeled how that particular flat rate versus when we put in the LEP weighting or the general formula. I think what we've said here is we haven't modeled the entire system, so we don't know how that looks. And I think what Superintendent Vandell said is that I don't think there's anything in natural law that speaks to concentration as the sine qua non, that without which you can't get this job done. It's just been the policy solution in Minnesota. Have I advocated for that? Yes. Will I continue to advocate for that? When Representative Gerlach was, or when Senator Gerlach was a mere state representative, we had a great discussion over on the House side on this. And I think it's a good policy to pursue and maintain. But I think that gets to what Mr. Lundell said about there's a certain level of politics in this process, and we're trying to recommend a funding framework that addresses what Mr. Kroonquist said. We have a new world where we're expecting all students to achieve at a high standard. And I guess I have to come down to, at the end of the day, where you have the highest concentrations of the lowest achieving students, I don't think you want to divest to a divestment isn't a strategy to get the job done.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So right now you have not totally bought into the flat per student weighting versus the concentration, at least I hear that. But could you, how many years have we had the concentration formula? I've kind of lost track. Could you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I believe it's been an integral part of compensatory since its inception. The biggest change
Which
in that
was?
Well, 1978, I had a nice meeting with Representative Szabo at the U.S. Capitol where he asked me a question about that formula, and I told him, well, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the details of that, and he barked out, familiar with it? I wrote it. So I think it goes back to somewhere at least in 1978. So,
Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hahn was pursuing a discussion here in terms of the amounts of money in relation to results. Do you have any records as to the concentration aid that has been put into the city of Minneapolis and how it, in fact, has reduced the disparities? Because obviously it's given there for the very students that the No Child Left Behind is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, even though we're expected to show in a more direct way that we are making a difference, it would seem that if we have in fact had as our general goal all the time and we've been putting money there, that we should have been making progress in reducing that and accomplishing something with that performance. How would you describe the progress that has been made in that direction as a result of the investment we've been making these years?
Mr. Gathwell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, and I would respectfully disagree with Senator Hahn about over the course and trajectory of the last 30 years that we haven't made progress. And I would just point out, and I didn't come armed with charts and graphs at this moment, but I'd be happy to provide them. And I just remind you that we have raised the bar of expectation. So as we continue to measure progress, we have raised the bar of expectation. So, for example, statewide on the MCA2s, everybody statewide tanked in terms of proficiency on the MCA2s. reading math, and especially the 11th grade math, statewide, because those tests were drawn to a higher standard. I just raised that as an example. But the specific answer to your question is, have investments in compensatory revenue on a with concentration as the foundation of the formula delivered results in terms of closing the gap? Yeah. And I can show you, especially on MPA reading and math, reducing the number of students scoring. And so this is, I'm going to describe verbally a bar graph that I could produce for you. But reducing the number of students scoring over the last, since 1998, for example, is the graph I think I have in levels 1 and 2, and increasing the number of students scoring in levels 3, 4, and 5. And what you wind up with, the number of students scoring in the proficiency level 2 and 3 tends to be kind of even or flat over the 5 or 8 years I'm talking about, because you're moving kids out of level 1 and 2 and through up and into 3, 4, and 5.
Mr. Chair, being a visual person, I do need to see that.
So yeah, I hope I'd be happy to provide that.
That was meant to at least plant that seed that I think this is a subject we need to pursue.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, I think to go to from the micro to the macro, I guess, as part of our efforts, we want to recognize the unique issues that exist, unique challenges that exist in Minneapolis, and I think that and we use the rational base to do that and then expand that to the state. What we're discussing about here in Minneapolis is the situation in Minneapolis is very, very important. And to have that discussion about, you know, we want to address that issue. The 0.75, and I think that, Mr. Kroonquist pointed this out, that was to generate what costs. I mean, the formula we won't be devising the final formula. Again, that's, we're lacking the status to do that or standing to do that. But we want to make sure that as we move forward that the challenges in Minneapolis, challenges in the other urban centers, St. Paul, what we're seeing happen in regional centers in terms of immigration, in terms of new Americans, in terms of available housing, those types of issues and the kind of different populations that some of these areas are now seeing, we need to have that all in one unified, one unified approach to doing that, and that's going to include many different segments. And I think that I want to assure those who represent urban cores and those who represent regional centers that what we're trying to do is have a statewide formula that really gets away from the Rob Peter, pay St. Paul kind of thing that some people believe is going on. We know that those districts have challenges, and we know that it's our moral obligation to help meet those challenges.
Mr. Chair, just to wrap it up, I think what we need to look at, because I know the idea of weighting pupils based on those needs is not a new idea. I remember it from school finance class back in graduate school long before I got here. But if you do have that weighting, whether some districts are going to have a few, some are going to have a lot. So right there, you're going to have a major differential in terms of the distribution of those resources. I think part of what we need that would be helpful to us so that it isn't totally political but rational and scientific is that what do people do with those additional resources focused on those children of need that can, in fact, make a difference? I know there are things that do work, and sometimes it's not as complicated as we might want to make it. And how does that support or rationalize that whether there's more on top of that that needs to be added or what? I think we need some graphic and some opportunities to see exactly what are some of the things that have in fact been done that make a difference, and find ways that we can encourage that we aren't just kind of throwing the money out on the table and people take it, and are they putting it to use then with strategies that will in fact make the difference? I think that Senator Saltzman was alluding to that point, but I think we need some understanding of that as well.
I think that over the course of the next few weeks we'll get it into much more in depth in some of these programs. And I'm going to take Senator Scheid's question, and then I think we have to move on. We'll have to leave here about 5 minutes to 11 because we have a session at 11. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of making some notes, and I think that Superintendent Vandal may have made some reference, I think, perhaps as far back as Senator Hand's question. I have a frustration. First of all, I don't do well reading the adequacy report. I'm going to struggle with it, and I'm going to try really hard. My brain just doesn't work that way to analyze what it is they're saying here. Maybe the answer is in there. But did you say, Superintendent, that you did take into consideration how services are being delivered rather than... I have a frustration that just putting more money has not produced the results that we were hoping for. And in the districts I represent, the achievement gap is not getting narrower. It's either staying the same or getting worse. And just more money isn't going to cut it. Because whatever it is we're doing, it's not right, it's not enough, or it's not the right method because the gap is still there. And I suspect, well, I know that it's going to take more money, but did you focus at all on how that money is used?
Mr. Vandal.
Maybe you've said this a number of
times. Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, in fact, this goes to Senator Olson's question as well. And there were all kinds of charges that this group could have undertaken. The delivery method that would close the achievement gap, the early childhood program, you're going to be talking about that in a few moments. There are lots of things that really were beyond the scope of our initial conversation. We started, go back to yesterday's presentation, we started with the governor's task force. The governor's task force suggested that there's another way to frame the funding of schools, and we set out to do that. We'd love to engage in the conversations about most appropriate delivery systems, but we have not. As a matter of fact, what we're standing on right now is this local control notion that local educators, given sufficient resources, will figure it out in the best way possible for themselves. Obviously, it needs to be vested in best practice, but nonetheless, it's still fundamentally that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the frustration, Mr. Chairman, that we feel. I mean, I think it's wonderful what you've done, and I'm going to try to keep that separate from my other concern of how we're using the dollars. One of the things that I think is really, really, really important about the achievement gap is engaging parents, and I don't have any great way to do that. I suspect it would cost a lot of money, but it's probably best left to the individual district. And so I buy into the local control piece too, although I would like to see more districts do more of that. One of my frustrations, and you mentioned it the other day, Mr. Chairman, was about ELL funding. And when the governor proposed cutting the reimbursement from 7 years to five, you know, the establishment and people who are expert, who have some expertise or all the expertise in that area, said, oh, we can't do that. That's a bad thing to do because we all know that to get academic English, it's going to take 7 to 10 years or something. And I say, excuse me, that's not good enough because 7 to 10 years, you get a child who comes to you and they're 14, well, you don't, then they never make it. And a kindergartner is not caught up till, you know, junior high. Well, I'm sorry, but that isn't going to get us there. And so there needs to be more looking at, well, maybe what we're doing isn't the best we could be doing. And so that's not really, I don't need to be saying that to you, but that's one of my frustrations with the adequacy thing is that I don't think we're doing some things, I suppose, adequately as it is. And we need to be doing more things better. And I think that probably means some things differently. And but that's really more for the committee than I'm not trying to instruct you. I'm just trying to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, no one would disagree with anything that you've just said. No one is a part of our coalition. We're a very unique coalition. Again, we talked yesterday about the rural part of this coalition, and it wasn't here today, but we've also got the MetroLink. We really are all vested in the success of our children. That's what this is all about. I sense you're moving another direction pretty quickly, and
yes,
you're
I think we need
can I make an interesting observation? I don't know if anybody else recognizes the irony of what's happening in these chambers on this day, because you're going to enact tax policy a little bit later. And that tax policy is going to give tax credits to teachers who go into their own pockets to pay for the materials that are required to deliver instruction. If we're engaged in an argument about sufficiency, that should be the answer, that you're going to give tax breaks to teachers. I hope you considered giving tax breaks to surgeons who bring their own utensils into the operating room, and to attorneys who bring their own legal pads, and to auto mechanics who bring their own carburetors from home in order to fix their... I mean, we know that's ludicrous, but nonetheless, it does speak to the fact that the sufficiency is really a question. How much is enough? I've been asked at this table before. I don't know that I have the unique answer to that question. APA has one answer. I believe there's a way to figure out how much is enough. How much is enough invested in a framework that's linked to student achievement is what we're all about. And we would love to continue to work with you down this path. What would we like you to do this year? Well, embrace our ideas wholesale. Fund them fully. What we would like you to do is to continue to work with us to create a rational formula. And we thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to make that case today.
Thank you very much, Superintendent, and
Mr.
Lundell, and Mr. Grathwall, and Mr. Krumquist. And all the questions that we got from our committee. I think it was a good discussion, one that's probably going to carry on over the next number of weeks while we're in session. And I appreciate you coming back the second day for some additional time.
How could I resist the drive or the entertainment?
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to shift gears here a little bit, and we have Dr. Barry Schaefer from the Minnesota State Director of Adult Education. And we'd like to ask him to start off. We're going to talk about the early education accounts. And Mr. Schaefer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Barry Schaefer. I'm the Director of Adult Basic Education at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm a little surprised because I'm usually not the first. Usually early childhood comes before me, but I'm happy to present. And I had a presentation to the House on Thursday, the same overview. You have a document in your packet that has it's called a fact sheet. It's a two-page document with the ABE logo in the upper left-hand corner. By the way, that's the only logo in the state that has ever been designed by a student. We had an ESL student from Mankato in a little contest we had design that logo for us. So we're proud of a student-designed logo for a state program. I'm going to cover just a few points from that fact sheet so that you have an overview of the adult basic education services in the state. The first important thing to note is the students that are eligible for this program are 16 and older and out of school. We are not a program where we're supporting K-12 students that are enrolled in school and having difficulty with basic skills. We're a kind of a second chance program, and in many cases we're a first chance program for immigrants and refugees that come and need English programming. We are often thought of as just a GED or adult diploma system, but in Minnesota we're a lot more than that. We have different kinds of programming. We certainly do offer, through our structure of ABE, GED and adult diploma services. We also offer English as a second language, which is now the biggest program we have under the whole adult basic education system. We believe in family literacy as well and have many programs in the state where these adults who need basic literacy bring their children to the programs to cooperate with ECFE and Head Start programs and provide dual services both for the adults and for the children. A lot of our students come for just general basic skills education, where adults are told typically at work that their skills are weak, and that might be in carpentry, or where their math skills are weak, or any kind of a business that requires them to read safety instructions and memos and that sort of thing. And if they don't have those kinds of skills, they might be in danger of losing their job. So we often have adult students coming for just a basic skills brush-up courses to learn very specific content areas. We offer U.S. citizenship classes, and the latest focus we've had in the past 3 years, we've had a priority on pre-employment education and workforce education, where our teachers go directly into businesses, especially manufacturing and food processing and those larger businesses, also hotel industries and lately healthcare industries, helping our immigrant workers learn English and perform at higher levels on the job. So we're getting into that market quite a bit with our programming. We also make the businesses pay for a lot of those services as well, so not strictly a state service. Our core content is basic skills, reading, writing, etc., and we do other things like computer literacy, but a person must have a defined weakness and need in the basic skill areas as identified on a standardized adult-appropriate test that that we use. Our enrollment, you can see we had 76,000 students last year come through our system. ESL was 51% of that. In terms of instructional time, however, two-thirds of the classroom hours in our system are ESL-delivered time. I'll jump down to outcome and results because I know you're a committee interested in accountability and outcomes. I want you to know that we have a standardized system of accountability in adult basic education that's defined by the federal government since we take their money. It's kind of like No Child Left Behind, but it's about adult basic education. And for the past 3 years, we have met all of our federally negotiated targets for results and are continuing to do that. We had over 6,000 GEDs issued in the state last year, and I'm happy to say that I think most of you have experienced GED graduation ceremonies or adult diploma graduation ceremonies in your communities and know that's just a marvelous event that is appreciated not only by these students but by their families and their children. One out of every 11 diplomas issued in this state was issued through the GED program. So we're not a hidden system anymore in the educational world. There's a great need for this kind of service, and our teachers are providing it. Moving on to this last page, I have some funding information for you, and you'll obviously get budget sheets that have the ABE funding structure on it. You can see that we get in this year almost $38 million in adult basic education funding from the state. None of that money goes to support my office. The state money is all used for direct service. There's a formula in which that's distributed to programs in the state, except for 2%, which is used for professional development services, which, again, are contracts to professional development providers and to special needs providers that work with our adults with disabilities. The federal money, which is about $6 million, is money that we do take some administration from and then can use that to support my office and other services, including additional professional development that we provide. We have been fortunate to seek successfully other grant programs. We have a Bush grant right now for $400,000. We have a grant from the Refugee Office of the Department of Human Services of $600,000. And we have a state grant that the legislature approved last year for $1.25 million to directly help the ESL population that we have here. Program delivery, we have 53 adult basic education consortia. Rather than have 400 school districts all receiving monies, we've aggregated our services into 53 consortia that are locally determined. School districts get together and decide where they're going to have an administrative unit and who's going to be the fiscal agent, and that's who we work with as our prime administrative unit of delivery. And we also embrace community-based organizations. We have over 25 community-based organizations working within our system to provide adult basic education. We have about 1,200 teachers, most of which are part-time, many of which also hold jobs in the K-12 system and are funded then additionally through the adult basic ed system. Our state law requires that teachers in adult basic ed be a licensed teacher. So it creates a system that is highly professionalized for delivery and success with our learners. The final piece of information I have is about literacy needs and facts in Minnesota. You can read that at your leisure, and I'll just tell you that we still have waiting lists, especially in the ESL arena and especially in the metropolitan Twin Cities area. So we're struggling to try to meet those needs. Not only are there people waiting, there is a need for a greater intensity of services. Many of our programs offer services 2-3 times a week, and smaller communities only one time a week. Learners, especially adult learners, don't want to linger in adult basic education. They want to get what they need, and they want to get out there in the real world and be self-sufficient and get employed and that sort of thing. So the greater intensity of services, I'm sure you're going to hear about. I know there will be some bills from Literacy Minnesota, our professional organization, that will come forward to you. I work closely with that organization to provide them information about where we're at in the state with delivery. So there are needs in adult basic education like there are in many other programs. And as you go forward with discussing funding for adult basic ed and for also early childhood, the one thing I'll leave you with is something you probably already know quite well. And I was asked in the House why we were a part of the early childhood. They have a separate committee for early childhood, and adult basic education is a part of that. And why were we there? And the simple answer to that is that if you know your research, children's improvement in school and many other areas, the best and first teacher that they have is their parent. And we have, in adult basic education, 2/3 of our adults that attend our classes are parents, and when we can provide them with an increase in their literacy skills, we are indeed providing their children with a greater opportunity to learn as well. So that's the ABE program.
Just a quick question on the programs where you deliver to the incarcerated?
Yes.
Is that the state prisons?
Mr. Chair, that's not only the state prison systems, with which there are 9 that we are delivering adult education, but it's also the county jails and local jails if they agree to have a teacher present. County jail is a little more difficult because the average stay is only about 40 days in a county jail. But most of the county jails do have a partnership with our providers who work 2 or 3 times a week, and Ramsey County is the best example of that kind of a program.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and sometimes it's hard to imagine all the different programs that you're involved in. And interesting about the ESL and the growth in that, and I think that's right. Probably pretty natural that we've seen that grow over the years. And it'd be interesting, Senator Scheid's question about how do you teach the ESL to adults. I think that would be an even more difficult job than to teach English to children.
Mr. Chair, it's a tremendously difficult job, but the students are tremendously motivated. It's when teachers make that shift, especially retired teachers or whatever, into adult basic education, I am told almost to the person how much they appreciate working with a student that really is, you know, excited to learn, wants to learn, and learning for a purpose. And they're there because typically it's an employment purpose, but it's also so I can help my child succeed in school. So it's a very rewarding but difficult job, as you mentioned.
Okay. Thank you very much,
Mr.
Chairman.
Senator Scheid. Mr. Chairman, if I might, the most wonderful day of the year for me here as a Senator Frank, honestly, is when the adult ESL students come over to the Capitol to visit from the Osceola School District. Usually there's somewhere between 50, 60 people, just a variety of ages, young people from countries I haven't heard of. And I'm pretty good at geography, but from all over, from elderly Russian immigrants to young Asian, Southeast Asian adults, but very young.
Yes.
I cry all the way through. I shake hands with each one and ask them where they're from and their name. And it's a very exciting time for them to be here, and it's a wonderful thing, you know, that you do. So we cannot stop doing this. It's
Thank you.
A beautiful thing, and important, obviously.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and members, while Mr. Schaefer is here, I think it's important for us to have a conversation about the missing appropriation in the ABE. And I would hope that maybe Mr. Schaefer could speak to that and discuss whether there's an urgency for us to deal with that for 2007.
Correct.
Dr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, members, I have been assured by Tom Melcher's office of the Department of Education and Finance Director that there would be some sort of bill proposed, some sort of adjustment proposed for you. Last year, the legislature approved a 3% increase in the adult basic education base, but through an oversight did not put the money, the extra 3% money, in the appropriation. And I've been told by the Department of Education Finance folks that there would be some sort of correctional bill that's more like a technical amendment. It's not something that should be kind of reconsidered. Did we really want to do this or not? The law was passed that there should have been a 3% increase. We've notified all of our programs of for this year's funding, this fiscal year, here's the money you would have gotten with the 3%. Here's the money that we've prorated for you right now, and that in the beginning of the session there would be some sort of bill coming forward. And I'm sorry, I don't know how that works in the process, but that would have that correction in it, and that additional 3%, which is about $1 million, would be distributed, made whole in our formula.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nauman,
to illuminate this a little bit, the formula was adjusted in law, but there was not a supplemental appropriation included in last year's supplemental bill to effectuate that. So the ABE program is funded in the current fiscal year at the amounts that were passed by the 2005 legislature, and that therein creates the problem. The Department of Education, in its forecasting process, did forecast the additional 3%, so it is a no-cost item to the legislature in terms of passing this bill. One of the implementation issues that I've been led to understand is that ABE programs, and Mr. Schaefer can maybe speak to this in more detail, are hesitating in spending the money because there is not an assurance that the money is there. And this will create, if they don't spend the money, some accounting issues for the department, in which books will not be closed for several years after the time frame in which they normally would if they don't spend the money. Is that an accurate representation?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's accurate.
Sure. All right, that's about the only first time I've ever heard that we can spend $1 million and it's a no-cost item. Senator Terese.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schaefer, I would like to know, in your presentation, I, as an immigrant, have been invited to visit numerous programs that really talk about, and their directors talk to me about the need to increase funding because they have a greater number of students coming to their schools and greater need. And we have families with young children, parents with young children. And I am surprised that you didn't provide that information here because I think it is important that you let us know. According to the programs that I visited, we are in crisis. We don't have enough funding for these programs right now. And I don't see any of that information in your report.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know what's in the governor's budget at the moment. I haven't seen what the governor's bill is going to be. I don't know that there's an increase for adult basic education programming in that budget, and I'm not at liberty to advocate for additional funds directly without that governor's approval. So I haven't mentioned a specific dollar amount need that we would have for that. I guess what I've tried to do is tell you that we have waiting lists, and we know that. And we have needs for greater intensity in programming so that there can be more opportunities for the people that are there to learn quicker and better. I am working directly with our professional organization, Literacy Minnesota, which I know will present very direct financial information about what it will cost to meet those waiting list type of needs. So I know you'll be getting that shortly. I can only mention to you that, yes, this program does have great needs, and very specifically in the ESL domain. And not only, I said the Twin Cities area, but in many locations, especially regional centers in outstate Minnesota, where there are other concentrations of immigrants who are taking jobs in various businesses around outstate Minnesota, that could benefit from increased adult basic education opportunities.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Next we have Nancy Reisenberg, prevention specialist. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Reisenberg, and I'm a prevention specialist with the Safe and Healthy Learners Unit, part of the No Child Left Behind program at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'm here to just give you a brief outline of some of the programs. I believe that there is a three-page piece of information in your packet regarding the prevention programs overview at the Department of Education. These programs are for K-12 students, and all of these programs on those three pages are federally funded. We do not currently have any state funding in the program. All but one of the programs is targeted for students that have been identified as not keeping pace or who are considered at risk. The non-targeted program is Title IV, which is a universal takes a universal approach. Title IV is ongoing funding that we get from the U.S. Department of Education Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. And that program is designed to address the issues of alcohol, tobacco, other drugs, and violence prevention. All of the other programs on this list are competitive grants that the Department of Education applied for and received. Let me briefly walk you through each of these federally funded programs. Title IV has three sections to it. Title IV Part B is the 21st Century Community Learning Centers. Basically, this is after-school programming for academic enrichment. Title IV Part A is the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Local Education Agency Program, and that is specific money that is distributed to the school districts on a formula based on their free and reduced lunch as well as their pupil enrollment, and that money is for prevention and intervention programming in the school districts for alcohol, tobacco, other drugs, and violence prevention. And then Title IV, Part A, the Governor's Program, is a competitive granting program. We currently have 12 different programs around the state that are funded through the Governor's Program, and the purpose of that of their programming is to reduce the number of dropouts, to reconnect students to school, and to try to ensure that students are engaged so that they don't even think about dropping out from school. So it's a retention dropout prevention program. Then, so that's a brief overview of the programs that are funded. The ones that we have applied for and received funding for include the HIV Prevention Education Program for school-age youth. That money comes from the Centers for Disease Control. The Dropout Prevention, Retention, and Graduation Initiative. This is another dropout prevention program where we're working with seven school districts around the state to apply some strategies to prevent dropouts, and that comes from the Department of Education. Then there's the State Data Grant, which also comes from the Department of Education, Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, and the purpose of that grant is to corral, if you will, data from agencies around the state agencies and other organizations so that there is an easy access to data for all folks members of the legislature as well as people in the communities. So those are the programs that we have funded. We have a couple of other initiatives that are on the last page, Steps to a Healthier Minnesota, the Minnesota Student Survey, the Student Support Services and Crisis Consultation, and then Operation Military Kids, which we are a partner with a number of different agencies to help support the children of people who have been deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq. The funding for this is in that information. Some of this is also included in your funding, the funding budget bill around No Child Left Behind programs. And I am wondering if there are any questions.
Senator Wieger and then Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your name again?
Nancy Wiestenberg.
Okay. Wiestenberg, how much money is needed to adequately fund Title IV Part B for those schools that are not meeting objectives for No Child Left Behind? It's competitive now for 38 that get the grants, but there must be a lot of schools left behind. So how much money would be needed to get the job done?
Senator Wieger, Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not able to answer that question. Let me just clarify, however, the Part B 21st Century Early Learning Communities, that program is an after-school program, and it is designed to support the day program of a school by providing to students academic enrichment as well as other kinds of enrichment, whether that's in arts or athletics or social activities, et cetera, to kind of complete the day. I could imagine that if you were to survey all of the school districts and all of the communities in the state, they would all say that in order to support all of their children, every community should have a 21st century after-school program. But that's an unscientific opinion. This money comes from the Department of Education in Washington, and I guess I'm not able to answer your question. However, I could have the person who manages that program, Sheila Orline, contact you with some opinions about
that. Thank you. Yeah.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Ms. Wiestenberg or Mr. Nauman can refresh my memory. 4 years ago, maybe three, we've totally wiped out things like after school money, state money for that. Do you remember how much that was? And my question then of you is, was that under your purview? Those programs were something that fell.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there was a after school program that was funded by the Minnesota legislature, and that money was unallotted. At the time of the crisis, the budget challenges that the state was facing, there were a number of programs that were unallotted, and the after-school programs were unallotted. I do not know how much that was, but that money was my unit was responsible for the overview of that programming.
Mr. Chairman, so one thing I remember, Mr. Chairman, about was I think it was a truancy program, trying to stop truancy in the Duluth schools, and I think that it was provided, I want to say, through Lutheran Social Services. I mean, there was grants that we gave to nonprofit community and other organizations, maybe even school districts themselves or whatever, for money. I'm just curious to know. I mean, it wasn't just after school things.
Chairman, Senator Scheid, my recollection is the same as yours. I haven't pulled up the site, nor do I recall the exact appropriation, but I believe it was in the million, maybe $2 million range that we were talking about. I'll be pleased to research that for you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nolan, I'd appreciate that because sure. I was really interested in particularly in after-school programming, and there's lots of talk in the districts I represent about trying to do more after-school activities. You have a ninth-grade girl crying, telling you that she's worried about her friends who are boys who are going to get themselves killed if they don't have something better to do after school. several of them, ninth grade kids, are living on their own in this girl's, among this girl's friends. And, you know, they are going to end up dead. Two younger people ended up dead in a car about five blocks from my home last night. Not teenagers, but, you know, the crime. I'm so deeply concerned about the crime, and I know that this has so much to do with prevention, and that's your area. So hopefully we'll be able to find some of that money and reinstate some of these proven programs, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Yeah, I think after-school enrichment grants, I think is what it was. It's a relatively small component, but I think one that has an awful lot of importance in many districts, and probably all districts, but I think in certain areas even more so, the relevance of it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Project Reconnect grants include some after-school programming. People in districts see after-school programming in a number of different, from a number of different lenses, including dropout prevention.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Next we have Dan Smith from Community Education. And members, we only have about 10 more minutes, and thank you so much for hanging in there before we go up to session. So, welcome, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Dan Smith, Supervisor for Adult and Career Education at the Department of Education. I think three pages in your materials about community education. I will try to be very brief. Community education programs are designed to expand the use of the schools by the community and to expand access to community resources by the schools. Districts reported about 2.5 million participants in community education programs in 2005, the latest year for which we have data. This is a duplicated count, so individuals who participated in more than one program would be counted more than once. However, it does not include individuals who participated in adult basic education or early childhood family education, which would have been reported separately to the agency. Each district should have a licensed community education director to operate its program, except very small districts. There are 56 districts with a census population of under 2,000 who are waived from that requirement, and the Minnesota Board of School Administrators also has the right to waive that requirement. Each district operating a community education program has a community education advisory council that advises the school board on the operation of the community education program, but the responsibility for the program rests with the school board. Community education revenue can be used for a variety of purposes. You'll see them listed as points 1 through 8 on the first page of the handout. General community education revenue is not to be used to subsidize the direct activity costs for adult enrichment programs. Some districts get additional community education aid for operating programs for adults with disabilities, and you will see six requirements on page 1 that talk about the adults with disabilities programs. Districts can also receive additional community education revenue for youth development and youth service programs, and you'll see some requirements 1 through 5 at the top of page 2 talking about youth development and youth service. Additionally, districts that operate youth after-school enrichment programs can access some additional revenue for that, and you will see requirements there. Districts are obligated to report participation in community education programs to the department annually, and so far we've received those reports from about two-thirds of the school districts in the state. The revenue for 2005-2006. Revenue is a combination of aid and levy, and then fees generated from participants in community education programs. The formulas are listed on the handout, and you'll see that about $2 million in state aid is matched with about $36 million in local levy, and districts report an additional roughly $180 million in revenue from fees and grants, et cetera, in the program. The department has no staff assigned to the community education program, so we provide minimal oversight, and community education programs do vary dramatically from one district to the next.
Are any of the programs that you offer, through community education, accredited programs like with colleges and universities, or can they be?
Mr. Chair, I believe that I know that there can be credited programs offered in the summer through community education on a fee basis for remedial education for students, and community education programs can have partnerships with colleges. I'm not personally aware of how that credit arrangement works. Okay. If I may, just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I added one additional. Page 3 talks about the Hearing Impaired Educational Support Services Program. About $70,000 a year is appropriated to provide hearing impaired note-taking or sign language interpreter services that would be unexpected costs in programs serving adults. These funds are dedicated only to school districts, technical colleges, and public or private community agencies. Our agency receives requests through the year and makes one payment at the end of the year, prorating as necessary. Last year was the first year in many that we have not appropriated the full $70,000.
It's a very community oriented and friendly program. Community education is one that has, it seems like it has a lot of good appeal out there amongst our communities, and you don't really think of it as, I didn't realize that there is $180 million plus two, so I mean, you got close to over $200 million in funds out there, and I know they're very extensive, the programming in different communities, but it's a well, highly thought of program. Yes, Senator Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Hassan.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Just a comment. If you notice on page 2, some districts operate after school enrichment programs, and one of the conditions is collaborating with other existing effective community resources. Part of the comment that was made in the previous testimony that funds were cut for after-school programs compounds the ability to access these dollars. In our district, we have the White Bear Lake Area Community Counseling Center, which serves more than White Bear Lake. It goes into Matamida, Vadnais Heights, and other communities, in conjunction with the suburban Ramsey Community Collaborative. A number of these programs lost their funding, which means the school district has no one to collaborate with. And so there's a compounding effect based on the decisions that were made a couple of years ago. And somehow we need to address those, the mental health and the other issues that some of these other programs serve are extremely important for the success of the students in school. Just a comment.
Thank you. All right. I'm not sure we have. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Aaron Carlson, I'm not sure we're going to get through the early learning services in the few minutes we have, but.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to come back and spend more time with you.
Yeah, I think we have session at 11, but. So maybe that might be best if we schedule another date. Thank you. Well, I think that's going to be it. We'll go up and hear what the governor is going to say and get the budget next week. So we should be able to get right to work after that. So. Thank you again, and see you next week. Committee is adjourned.